shape or size or outside shell. It's fun to ionize just a little atom of CL with an unfilled shell. But somewhere in this sea lurks handsome sodium.
Good morning. You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, and the time is now just about 15 seconds before 11 o'clock. Coming up on The Boo at 11:30, Between the Lines Radio brings you a roundup of the week's underreported stories. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to KBOO.fm and clicking on Donate. Now, stay tuned as Health Watch talks to Peggy Orenstein, author of the New York Times bestseller Girls and Sex, about the generation gap that has emerged between parents and their daughters.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Steve Early Lecture, taking place Sunday, March 19th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book regarding the transformation of Richmond, California, from a fossil fuel-dominated town to one of the most progressive cities on the West Coast. Again, that's Steve Early, Sunday, March 19th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1121 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Ellen Goldsmith, licensed acupuncturist, your host every second Monday of the month. Today, our guest is Peggy Orenstein, author of the New York Times bestseller, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape, published last year, which just came out in paperback. Her book offers a clear-eyed picture of the new sexual landscape girls are navigating and how they are negotiating it. Drawing on in-depth interviews with nearly 100 young women and a wide range of psychologists, academics, and experts, renowned journalist Peggy Orenstein goes where most others fear to tread, pulling back the curtain on the hidden truths, hard lessons, and important possibilities of girls' sex lives in the modern world. It has been hailed as a very important book for young women and women in the 21st century. Peggy Orenstein is the author of other best-selling books, Cinderella Ate My Daughter and Waiting for Daisy, as well as Flux, Women on Sex, Work, Kids, Love and Life in a Half-Changed World, and the classic Schoolgirls, Young Women, Self-Esteem, and the Confidence Gap. A contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, as well as other major newspapers and magazines, she has contributed commentaries to NPR's All Things Considered and the PBS NewsHour. She's been a keynote speaker at numerous colleges and conferences, as well as a featured guest on major television news shows. Peggy Orenstein, welcome to Health Watch.
Thank you for having me.
So, you say that girls today are living with unique contradictions, you said this in your book, as they make sexual choices that actually put them between a rock and a hard place. We've moved forward in many ways, but in some ways, you say, not very, very far at all.
Yeah, you know, I think that for me, one of the big takeaways from doing this work was that young women today feel entitled to engage in sexual behavior, but they don't necessarily feel entitled to enjoy it.
So that's a big difference. You talk about this kind of sexual justice or
intimate justice.
Intimate
yeah,
justice, yes.
The whole book and the framework of really, you know, social justice framework. And that phrase was coined by a psychologist named Sarah McLellan at the University of Michigan. And what it means is that sex has political implications as well as personal ones, just like, you know, who does the dishes in your home or who vacuums the rug. And it raises similar questions around economic disparity, inequality, and mental health, and violence. And we have to ask who's entitled to engage in an experience, who's entitled to enjoy it, who's the primary beneficiary, and how each partner defines good enough. And, you know, honestly, those are really tough questions for a lot of adult women to grapple with, and sometimes traumatic. But for me, when I was looking back and interviewing girls and thinking about their early sexual experience, I just didn't want those experiences to be something that they have to get over.
Right. There's this, there's so much hypersexualization these days. You talk about this in your book as well. It's ubiquitous that it becomes almost invisible.
Yeah, and, you know, what has happened is that there's been this conflation, this merging in girls' minds of kind of performing sexiness versus understanding their sexuality and feeling their bodies. And, for instance, one young woman who showed me a picture of herself going out to a party, a college party, and she was wearing, you know, that kind of contemporary classic outfit of the little crop top, short skirt, 5-inch heels, you know, and she said, "I never feel more liberated than when I'm wearing skimpy clothing." And I said, "Well, you know, that's really interesting. I'd like to talk more about that." And as we continued, she said that a year earlier she wouldn't have worn that outfit because she weighed 25 pounds more. And what she said was, you know, some guy at the party might have called me the fat girl, and that would have been bad for my mental health. So, you know, leaving aside why, you know, there's a lot of things that brings up, but you have to ask, how liberating is it really when humiliation lurks right around the corner? And, you know, who gets to decide and how and what does that mean about who gets to wear what and who gets to be sexual and who gets to be sexy and all of that?
Yeah, you talked about in the beginning of your book, there was a young woman and a high school senior in the auditorium reacting to her principal's talking about their dress code, how they shouldn't dress certain ways. I wondered if you could just... Yes, the dress. The infamous
dress code. One of the biggest questions from both parents and girls. But yeah, you know, that was a really interesting scene because the principal, and this was in a very progressive school district, was saying, you know, was going on and on about the girls' dress and how they shouldn't wear anything that their grandmothers, you know, wouldn't want to see them in, and that basically he was shaming the girls and blaming them for, basically saying that if they were harassed in the hallways, that it was kind of their own fault. And one of the girls stood up, and she had learned in that very school district that you shouldn't let people say things like that about young women. And she stood up and said, you know, said her name and said, what you're saying is slut shaming and it's wrong, and boys need to be responsible for their own choices. We're not responsible for what they say about our bodies, and, you know, and on and on and on. And he said, yes, you're absolutely right, and girls don't dress like that, you know. And she was just really outraged. But at the same time, you don't want to make, and I think this a lot as a parent, I'm the parent of a teenage daughter, you don't want to turn self-objectification into a feminist act. And so we have to be careful that, you know, what. So this girl on another day was wearing, you know, a little kind of bustier thing or something to school, and suddenly she felt really good about herself, really good in it, and then she hit the hallway and guys started catcalling her, and she started feeling like a thing, you know, and thought, oh no, this is not good at all. And there's a way that when we push girls and start judging them all the time about dress and sexuality, that we force them into a place where they're rebelling by dressing that way, where they're expressing feminism and sexuality by dressing that way. And we know there's reams of research, stacks of research on the impact of self-objectification on young women. And so I think part of the challenge, and it is a huge challenge, is not just to tell girls, you know, don't dress like that, but to engage them, and boys too, in a critique of a culture that wants them to dress like that and what the impact is on their mental health, on their psychological well-being, on their cognition, on their political activism. I mean, it's like across the board that self-objectification has a dampening impact on young women, and sometimes a dangerous one.
Absolutely. I'm a mother of a teenage daughter as well, so I read this book with great interest. And
it's tough.
And it was you brought up, like, you know, it's tough.
Yeah, and when I talk to girls, and they will, you know, will have this whole conversation. They'll say, well, what do we do? You know, what do we do about this? What do we dress? How do we dress? What do we buy? You know, like, they want very specific things, girls, always, when, you know, when I talk to them. And I'll say, look, I wish I could give you an easy answer, but I think every woman, whether she is 15 or 65, wrestles with these issues, and we all have to find our way through in a way that, you know, feels like we have integrity for ourselves, and everybody has to eventually find that way themselves. But I can give you this information, and it can help you see what your choices are, and then maybe you can make them more clearly.
So, I mean, how can parents help their teens? It's, you know, it's as, you know, you use these two words, they're gender words. The girls say, oh, it's awkward, and the boys say it's hilarious, you know, when they're uncomfortable. But, you know, if this is a problem for teens and also grown women, and grown women are kind of uncomfortable, and it's awkward to talk to a teenager who doesn't want to hear anything about it. When it comes to sex and, you know, that kind of thing, you know, how can parents even break through their own issues to help their kids?
To talk about sex, it's a really good question. And ideally, you would have started when your child was very small.
Right.
And if you're stepping in at, you know, 13, 14, 15, it is a harder thing to do. But, you know, I think... I encourage people to go to my website and pull up interviews or pull up radio programs and, you know, podcasts and listen to them in the car when you've got your child.
Oh, that's very sneaky.
Yeah, and I swear that part of the reason I wrote this book was so that I could, bring my own daughter to interviews that I do or to readings. When the book first came out, and it sort of allowed her to hear all the things I wanted to tell her without having to say it directly. And it did. I mean, obviously, it's opened up huge doors, you know, in our own conversation over the years. But because I think the reason I advise that is when it comes in through sort of a third-party source like that, and you're talking about issues of oral sex, and you're talking about issues of intercourse and all of these things that I often talk about in interviews, it's a really easy jump to say, hey, you know, what's going on in your world? Is that going on with your friends? What do you think about that? What do you think she's right? Do you think she's wrong? You know, so there's a way that I thought that the book itself and interviews that I did could act as a jumping off point for parents who are entering this conversation with teenagers and for teenagers themselves. I mean, it's one of the things that's been really gratifying to me is that the book really has taken off among girls, among high school girls in particular. I think college girls as well, but I hear from so many high school girls who are reading the book that it really makes me happy.
Oh, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, the last chapter in your book is What If We Told Them the Truth, which is, you know, what you've done in this book. And it really takes us beyond that classical sex ed class where, you know, you learn about the ovaries and the fallopian tubes and periods and condoms, et cetera.
Yeah.
And, you know, you kind of think, okay, I've told them that, you know, my job's done.
I know, that's what I would have thought. And it was interesting to me to really have my eyes opened about what real sex education is, which is about relationships, which is about personal choices, which is, you know, frankly, discussing pornography and its impact, which is huge on young people right now, and discussing, you know, not just making sex into intercourse and this race to a goal, and not just talking about condom use, all of that. You know, what we think of as comprehensive sex education is very, very narrow, and that's already... you know, so controversial. So one of the things I did was look at the ways that sex ed worked in other countries, and I particularly looked at Holland. And there was a study that looked at 400 randomly chosen girls from two demographically similar colleges, one in Holland and one here, that were talking about their early sexual experiences. And in every respect, whether it was more positive outcomes like, you know, knowing your partner very well, being able to talk to your partner, preparing for the experience, enjoying the experience, or fewer negative outcomes like pregnancy and disease, the Dutch were way ahead. And when they did one-on-one interviews, they found that the girls credited their parents, teachers, and doctors from talking to them at a very young age about sex, pleasure, and the importance of mutual trust in their relationships. And what really struck me was the difference between the parents. And it wasn't that American parents were less comfortable talking about sex, but we framed all those discussions in terms of risk and danger. And
Right. The
Dutch talk about balancing responsibility and joy. And as a parent myself, that really hit me because, like you said, I am quite sure that had I not delved into this research and done this book, that I would have told my own daughter about contraception, about disease protection, and, you know, because I'm very modern, I would have talked about sexual consent. And I would have thought I did a good job. And I realize now that that is really only about, you know, a quarter of the conversation that we need to have.
Yeah, and I think it's evident in your book and from the research you did, and especially around the work in Holland, that was quite outstanding when I read that. But teens really need grown-ups.
They do, and we think, you know, another thing that struck me in the difference between the Dutch and Americans was a difference in the perception of teenage development. And so we think of teenagers as developing, you know, independently from the family, and that there's a point where they create a rift, and that it forces them to sort of lie about their behavior to us and to be kind of two people, especially girls. So they're one, you know, good daughter at home, and then they're another person in the world. And I saw that very much in the girls that I interviewed, in the sense that they were, if I had met them and was talking to them about their educational goals, their professional aspirations, their extracurricular activities, I mean, these girls were dynamos. And then we would start talking about their personal lives, and it was like they were a totally different person. And I still will walk into classrooms or schools and think, oh, well, these girls are completely different. They won't even know what I'm talking about. They always become a different people once we start talking. And so that was really interesting to me. And in Holland, they have this word that I can't pronounce. It's something like, you know, and it means cozy togetherness. And mm-hmm. It's this idea that teenagers are supposed to develop interdependently within the family, and all of these things like sex, alcohol, all the things that we sort of, you know, pretend aren't happening are openly discussed. And so I was reading Amy Shallett's book, Not Under My Roof, and she talks about a Dutch mom that the daughter says, well, of course, my mother was the first person I wanted to tell after I had intercourse for the first time. And I came home, and she was at the kitchen table with her friend, and they said, oh, great, did you have a good time? Did you have an orgasm? Did he? I tried to imagine American parents having that conversation with their children, and it was hysterical.
It's hard to imagine.
Very hard to imagine.
You know, this idea, you know, of secrecy that kids have to have. And, you know, you also explored this across gender preference, lesbian women, women who identify neither as neither gender. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what you found in the experience of lesbian women, because it's a different thing.
It was really different. So let me just back up for a second to say that among straight women, and this is across the board, it's not just in the teenage years, but, you know, with girls, they were, what research has found is that young women, well, women in general, but this was done on college women, are more likely than young men to measure their own sexual satisfaction by their partner's pleasure. So in a straight couple, they'd say, if he had an orgasm, you know, then I'm happy.
Hmm.
And young men are more likely to measure their satisfaction by their own pleasure. So they'll say,
that's a problem.
I was happy. So girls' pleasure and orgasm are secondary at best in heterosexual encounters, in certainly in the teen years and the college years. And girls would talk about that. But that focus on the partner's pleasure remains when they're in a same-sex pairing. And so the orgasm gap that you see in heterosexual couples disappears.
Hmm.
And girls actually climax in same-sex relationships at the same rate as boys. And what gay and bisexual girls would tell me was that they felt freed when they were in same-sex encounters to get off the script and to find a sexual encounter that works for them. And they also really, you know, helped me question the idea of virginity as defined by first intercourse. Because obviously, you know, a gay girl could have 500 partners and not have had heterosexual intercourse. And then, you know, I asked one girl, how did you know that you weren't a virgin anymore? And she sort of laughed and said, you know, I wasn't sure myself. And we had this whole discussion, and she decided she wasn't a virgin anymore when she'd had her first orgasm with a partner. Mm. And I was so blown away. But I mean, I thought, what if just for a minute we thought that was the definition? Mm. You know, how that would change. Because we young people learn from the media, you know, from one another, that sex is a race to a goal, and that the only thing that counts is intercourse, which means that all these other behaviors that they're engaged in, you know, are not sex, and that therefore they're not subject to the same rules, the same respect, the same compassion for your partner, the same rules around consent, when in truth they should learn that sex is a pool of experiences that's about attraction and arousal and desire and touch and giving and receiving pleasure and, yes, you know, orgasm, but, you know, but a whole range of things. Because what I always say when I talk to young people is, who's really the more sexually experienced person? Because they're all obsessed with this thing they call experience. You know, is it the person who's made out with a partner for 3 hours and, you know, kissed and experimented with erotic tension and communication and sensuality? Or is it the person who gets drunk at a party and hooks up with a random in order to, you know, cash in their V card before they get to college?
Wow. Yeah. This, you bring up the alcohol issue, which is a huge, scary issue, especially for parents of teenagers, both girls and boys, because so much harm comes to both boys and girls when they're drunk. And
yes,
of course,
beyond sexual issues.
Yeah, beyond sexual issues. But this
what we know statistically is that it's not that there's more kids that drink than in the past, but that the ones who drink much more.
Mm.
They binge at much higher levels and more often than kids in the past.
And what you also
that's where the real, you know, I don't know that, you know, it would be such a big, if a kid had a glass of wine, you know, but when they have 6 or 9, you know, this is an issue. And so the binge drinking is a huge thing among high school and college kids. And when they're in a culture that, you know, we call the hookup culture right now, which is, you know, obviously casual sex has always existed, but the idea that sex should precede, or I'm sorry, intimacy should precede rather than arise from a relationship, so that, you know, sexual contact comes first and then you see if you like each other, that's normalized is what has changed, as opposed to casual sex being sort of the exception and the relationship being more the rule.
Mm.
And if you want to have a sexual encounter with somebody that you don't really know, alcohol becomes not just like lubrication, it becomes essential. Because what Lisa Wade, who's a sociologist at Occidental, says is that it creates a compulsory carelessness necessary to engage in a hookup.
Yeah, and they're much more subject to rape or date rape or...
Well, what happens, I mean, it was really interesting to me because I didn't want the book to be... The sexual assault discussion, the new open, you know, the advocacy, sort of burst forward as I was beginning the book. And I did not actually start thinking, I want to write about assault. I wanted to write about how girls viewed desire, how they viewed pleasure, how they viewed consensual sex. But both because of what was going on in the culture at large and because of what the girls told me, I certainly couldn't ignore assault and more than assault in some ways, really intense coercion in their relationships. And so, and it's really tempting, I think, to focus our conversation around about alcohol on girls, you know, don't drink that much. And certainly, we need to talk to girls, you know, to all kids about not drinking that much, but to girls about the unique impact of alcohol on the female body, which is different than on the male body. We can't drink as much, even if we weigh the same, even if we're as big. You know, drink for drink, we get drunker, and we get drunker faster. And so all of that is important, and understanding judgment and all that. But what's also important is to talk to boys, because what we know is that alcohol impairs boys' judgment. It makes them more likely to engage in behavior that they wouldn't be engage in if they were straight, to be more aggressive, and when they do assault, to be more aggressive in those assaults, and it makes them less likely to step in as bystanders than they would be if they were sober. So it's not really good enough to just focus on girls. And, you know, as rape advocates, college rape advocates will tell you all the time, anti-rape advocates, will tell you that the only thing that 100% of rapes have in common is a rapist. So we really have to shift our messaging at least equally to boys.
Right. So again, it comes back to how can the grown-ups help in a climate, whether it be in a school or at home or in conversation? Where's the hope?
Well, you know, as I said, I think that this idea of balancing responsibility and joy is really important. I think, you know, ironically, our president has offered us an opportunity to talk to issues of assault and about assault and coercion with our kids by his own behavior. Unfortunately, he has given permission and legitimized that behavior, but he's also allowed those of us who object to that and don't want to raise children to think that that's acceptable behavior, to have really open discussions about our values and about consent and about reciprocity and about coercion. And also, you know, in the education that I witnessed, and I followed one teacher in particular named Karis Dennison, who lives in Marin. She's a national consultant on sex education, and she, sitting in one of her classes, they were talking about the baseball metaphor for sex. You know, the one that we all learned.
Right.
Running the bases, you're going to. And one young man raised his hand and he said, "You know, I never thought about it before, but in baseball, there's winners and there's losers. So who's the loser supposed to be in sex?"
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was such a small moment, but I really think it was transformational for that boy. And I really think that when he goes into his encounters, whether they're for, you know, 20 minutes or 20 years, he will go in more as a partner and less as an adversary who sees girls' limits as a challenge he's supposed to overcome. And I was really moved by that. And I really believe that kids want to work these issues out open-heartedly. They want to work them out together. And that if we can get over our squeamishness and our fears and our denial, that we can raise more compassionate, healthier kids. And there's not a lot of difference, really. You know, we silo sexual behavior over, you know, over there somewhere. But really, the way we want kids to behave in those relationships is exactly the way we expect them to behave in the rest of their lives. You know, with compassion, with ethics, with benevolence, with kindness, with respect, with reciprocity. You know, it's no different. We want them to be good citizens in all situations, and sexuality is no exception.
Absolutely. And the other point you brought up, really, that I think parents seem to forget is that it's quite natural, sexuality, and even teenage sexuality.
Yeah, it really is. I was not going into this, you know, for many years, the research on teen sexuality was just like, make them stop.
Don't get pregnant, right?
don't get pregnant, don't get a disease, and make them stop. And the other piece, you know, is that a lot of these kids that I was talking to are the product of abstinence-only so-called education, which is was a disaster and which is at risk now of returning under Trump, and is still, you know, around in many states, but has the federal dollars in the proposed budget for 2017 under Obama were slashed. Those may be reinstated. I don't know. But, you know, that is not only, it's not a zero-sum abstinence only. It's harmful, and it's demonstrably so, statistically so. So that is hurting our kids. And these kids that I spoke with, I'll tell you, you know, none of them, very few of them had good sex education in school, or even what we would consider today, you know, comprehensive, like learning about condoms or something. A lot of them, most of them, had abstinence-only education, which included things like one girl telling me that her teacher unwrapped a peppermint patty for some reason and threw it on the floor and said, "Do any of you girls want to eat that?" And they all said no. And the teacher said, Well, that's what it means. If you're open, nobody wants you. That was their sex education. This was, you know, just a few years ago. So, you know, that sort of thing, we're raising a generation in ignorance while simultaneously bombarding them with sexualized messages in the culture. And that, you know, no wonder that's a toxic stew for them. No wonder it is. And I think, you know, as caring and thoughtful parents, we've just got to get over it and do better. And, you know, I had one thing. Well, no, I'll just stop on that.
Well, we do. And I think you give us a lot of resources in this book. So I know you're going to be a featured speaker at South by Southwest in Austin later on this month.
Monday,
yes. And so if people are in Austin, they should be sure to go see you. Otherwise, how can people be in touch with you and get more resources and buy your book?
Oh, well, you know, you can. The paperback just came out, so you should be able to buy it in a bookstore near you or complain if you can. Or, you know, on any of your online resources, of course, IndieBound or Amazon or whatever. My website is peggyornstein.com, which has a contact button. And Facebook, of course.
Okay.
Twitter, all those things.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being with us. We've been speaking with Peggy Orenstein, the author of Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Thank you, Peggy Orenstein, for being with us today on Health Watch.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Ellen Goldsmith, licensed acupuncturist, your host. You can listen to this episode and more episodes of Health Watch online and at kboo.org/healthwatch.
Please join us on Saturday, March 25th for an Archives Database Edit-a-thon and party. This event will run from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We are recruiting current and past KBOO volunteers and listeners who hold knowledge of KBOO's 49-year history, and we are recruiting archivists, librarians, and any other person that enjoys information seeking and data entry to document this collective knowledge. This event is free.